webcasting to the world.
You remember the moment you saw yourself and God in you, and you were one with the universe and God and everybody?
Knowing the truth about the gospel.
You were one with the prostitutes and pimps and priests and kings, and there was nobody on earth that was better than you nor less than you.
That we are all righteous.
And no one on earth was any less in Christ than anyone else.
That's Mike Williams, and this is the Gospel Revolution.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast for the 18th of February, 2016, broadcasting from the home of Redemptionism, where we love every train of thought visiting our station of freedom. We're coming to you from the GR Studios right here in Music City, USA, Nashville, Tennessee, where we say that if all the people who had ever gone to sleep in church had been laid end to end, they'd have been a lot more comfortable. And here from the Gospel Revolution Cathedral in Houston, Texas, is that great unteacher, the hope of all heretics, and the Pope of pontifical profundity, as well as the founder and president of the Gospel Revolution, Mr. Michael Williams. G'day, Michael.
G'day, Barris Bartlett.
I'm sorry, I didn't address you by your title. Pope Michael.
Exactly. Well, you know, I saw this morning that the Pope got riled at one of his admirers. But I think the guy pushed him down, so he probably had a right to get upset.
Well, I would call you the playful Pope, except that I think that a few other popes have beaten you to it.
Now, don't start comparing me to some popes now.
Oh, man, if I did, I think you'd come up head and shoulders. I mean, it's, well, let's not go into the Pope.
Yeah, let's not do that.
It's just far too dangerous living in a country. Well, at least we don't live in Northern Ireland where the Catholics will come around and shoot us if we say something bad about their Pope.
You know, I just, last night I watched again with a friend of mine. I watched again one of my all-time favorite movies, Chocolat. And
Chocolaca.
No, Chocolat.
Oh, Chocolat. Using the gentler European accent.
That's the name of the movie. And it is. So you've never seen it?
Never seen it, mate.
Oh, my gosh. Recommended to all gospel revolutionaries. It's a Judi Dench movie.
Well, say no more. Judi Dench will do it for me every time.
Oh, my gosh. This movie is so good. And it takes on Catholicism directly, religion inclusively, and paganism. And it's got Johnny Depp in it. It's just, it really.
She must have made it her intention to tie her life's work up with attacking the church because she brought out, what, Euphemia a couple of years ago?
Philomena. Yeah.
Yep.
So that was very heavily revealing about Catholicism, and this one is, it's all about that.
Well, how do I spell it?
Chocolate, I think.
Well, that doesn't spell chocolate. You're just a pretender. You're just a social climber, you are. Yeah, it's like a pretender? Moi?
Anyway, yeah, goodness, I was watching that, and you just get another dose of the clarity of the history of all of this. This movie is so well done. It's just
you know, we are so fortunate because we live in an age where it's impossible for anyone to say this did not happen. Now, I know that there are just haters out there, but you know what haters are like. Haters are the kind of people who will if you walk on water, they'll just say it's because you couldn't swim. Yeah, haters hate because that's what haters do, like Holocaust deniers and that. But we live so close to this history that when we dissect it, there's no denying it. And yet they lived so close to us, they didn't realize how close they were to the internet and everything, and getting all of this becoming disclosed. So they just kept on with what had worked for them for centuries.
Yeah, for sure. You know, when we talk about Catholicism, you got to realize that, and when we talk about Christianity in general, we're not referring to the individuals who attend these places or participate in them because they're doing the only thing they know to do. But it doesn't mean that we should not point out the fallacies that are promoted by these doctrines. And Catholicism really is, Barris, at the root of much of, because they were in charge of, the translations of the New Testament. And much of the, I guess, retranslations, if you will, especially when it went into the King James Version, of the Old Testament. Many years ago, I finally decided that Protestantism, as far as compared to the gospel, that Protestants are just minor Catholics anyway.
Now, what does Randy French call them? He calls them Reformed Catholics.
Ah, yeah. That's what he calls Protestants.
Yeah, I call them the bastard orphans of Catholicism. But we're all pretty much saying the same thing. And here's the interesting thing I've discovered. Protestants have no church history outside of the Catholic Church. They cannot tell you, apart from one or two things, the references for which they have in the early church fathers that are still extant, but they're still the only references they have, and they are still the only references that the Catholics didn't burn.
Yeah.
So it is a fair comment to say that Protestants have no church history, no genealogy. They have absolutely no genealogy outside of the Catholic Church. Now, the exception to these would not be Episcopalians or Anglicans or Church of England, as they actually did branch off the Catholic Church, but would be people like the Anabaptists, the Hutterites, or that whole group, which never were in the Catholic Church, always did. And we really don't know their history, except that they would tell you, well, we were the Church of Acts, we were the original Christians, but no one can honestly make that claim. There are one or two groups that did come up alongside the Catholic Church, but we're not part of that whole mess. But Protestantism, Lutheranism, Anglicanism, and all those different competing brands, they're competing corporations are what they are. They're corporate because you take away their money, their income, and they would soon crumble. That makes them corporate in my book. And they are brain-chained because they insist that if you don't believe like them, then you have got problems, not them.
Mm-hmm.
Competing corporations. Michael, how's the world turning in the gospel revolution?
Well, you know, if you look at the big picture of this, it really is quite amazing, Barris, from, you know, South Asia to Africa. My goodness, we don't even know a lot of what's happening. We always forget one of the real gospel revolution impacts is right straight out of Hong Kong, Dr. Li Lao Song. The transformation that has occurred in his life, he shares the gospel there. I believe he's a surgeon. He flew from China for our first gospel revolution convention that we had here in Houston, brought his brother with him, and still is a very strong financial supporter of Mike Williams Ministries and the gospel revolution. We can't tell you all the places that the gospel has inspired people and is transforming lives.
And then we've got Pep Washburn, whose book, Menominee, The Touching Spirit.
Yes.
Now that guy, it sounds like Pep is about to have his book published in Turkey or in Turkish. I don't know what the language we call it there.
Yeah.
And I just saw this morning on Facebook that PBS are going to broadcast a reading of his book.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Phenomenal, isn't it?
It really is. Go Pep.
Yeah, go Pep. Oh, we love you, mate.
We do indeed.
Every week at the end of the show, I kind of try to circle about advertising a different book. Sometimes it's Mike, sometimes it's Bob Hines. But you really need to get Pep Washburn's book, Menominee. Touching Spirit. just go to Amazon and buy the thing because it's just gorgeous. And I think, I mean, if you're dead set lucky and you go to Amazon, you might get a free Kindle edition, but just go there and get one. Just buy the hardcover and enjoy it. And then after you've read it and after it's touched your heart, give it away to someone that matters. Oh, Michael, I have something both distressing and surprising to tell you.
Okay.
We've caught up, and today we're going to be handling dualism.
Woo-hoo!
Heaven and hell.
But we finally get to go to hell?
But before we do.
Oh, there's always a delay to getting to hell.
Mate, I love teasing you. I wanted to just give a shout-out to Jeannie up in Calgary, who is coordinating our tape recovery exercise. And in this, what we're doing is we're collecting all of our old messages because, believe it or not, we don't have all of them. And so we've been putting out to all of our people to let us get those tapes. Jeannie, thanks so much for just hanging on to them and arranging the Canadian end of things with that. But anyone who in America, anyone in the US, anyone around the world who has any of our old tapes, if it's at all possible, we would like to ask you for them back. And in return, we are going to send you one copy of, now, this is not a CD copy, although I'll make it for you if you want, but it's MP3 copies of everything that we get back. In other words, if you just send us 5 messages that you happen to have and we end up with 5,000, you're going to get 5,000 MP3s. It's just as simple as that. They'll be all there for you. Now, for those of you who have to live without them for a little while, I'll be talking to Jeffrey, and Jeffrey, maybe we can give these people something in the meantime to see them over their Mike Williams withdrawals. So let's see what we can do.
And Barrett, tell me, what did you think about that Jeannie? I know you got to meet her in Canada the last 2 trips.
Are you kidding me? She buys my buffet dinner on
did
the Sunday.
She really?
How do you not love someone like that?
And her son, Neil.
Oh, Neil, is he is. Neil is woven gold. I love it.
He is indeed.
And amen. Man, does he go for the good looking chicks? I can tell you. having lunch with him down in the bar down there was like, I just had to watch myself because I remember I'm 64 years old, and you know I don't want to have a heart attack. But he keeps saying, "Oh, what about that one? Oh, look at that one." And chatting up the bar. I mean, he's. I love him.
He's loaded with personality. Now, the thing that we remind the folks of is that Jeannie is the daughter of Grace, who attended our meetings. She was into her elderly years, a broader daughter. She loved the gospel. Neil didn't come around until after his grandmother had passed away, but the gospel eventually had a real impact in his life also. So this is 3 generations of a family that the gospel has really made a great impact in.
Jeannie asked me a question in Calgary, and she said, "Where do you get all of your information from?" And I kind of blew her off, and I said, "Well, you know, the internet's a great place to get information, but the problem is that you've got to, you know, there's just as much crap on the internet as there is truth. And you've got to figure out how to pick the difference." And I kind of left it at that. But when the truth's told, my whole life I have found history and language fascinating. I just love both. How do I find the stuff that we present here? How do you find the stuff we present here, Michael? Well, we just don't find it that week. This is stuff we found over the course of many decades.
Yeah.
Some of them, they just... the dots did not join, so we had to wait until we had more light to join the dots. Other things are just factual, historical data that we've learned from kids, really, and going on. And as I posted on the web today, our passion has always been for the truth. Our passion has been to find out what are the facts, regardless of what we think should be the facts.
Yes.
Regardless of what we were told were the facts. Mm-hmm. And I wrote on Facebook today, I wrote, "Truth is not necessarily what you believe, cannot be conformed to your opinion, can exist outside your knowledge, is a consistent pattern of facts, and without truth you have nothing to rely on."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's at our core, Jeannie. We have somehow, through no, I don't think through any special effort of our own, but somehow we've just been devoured by the search for the truth. And everything else has just come up to grow around that, you know, our knowledge, general knowledge, historical knowledge, biblical knowledge. I mean, everything else really just came up around that, even though at the time we thought that they were the priorities.
Yes, for sure. And my goodness, is all of the folks in Canada, it's a good place just to salute those folks. You know, you always do a survey up there as to how many listen to the show, and there's not many. we have poked and prodded. These folks are some of the greatest supporters of the Gospel Revolution and Mike Williams Ministries on the planet, and yet they just haven't connected with our show. They've never have, and I don't understand it. We do everything but threaten them. Of course, it's hard to threaten these folks. We've taught them so much gospel. They don't take threats. They laugh me off, you know, when I try to do that. And but yeah, this thank you guys and our Canadian folks that made this such a successful time for Barris and I and the Gospel Revolution and Mike Williams Ministries.
Oh yeah.
And we just thoroughly enjoy coming up. And I'm so glad that I was able to introduce you, Barris, to them and them to you. Mm. And I can tell that they really do enjoy it. And I know beyond the shadow of a doubt that you enjoy the brunch. I mean, the people.
Oh, it was funny. I came downstairs after my first session, only to find you and Jeannie in a huddle, and you came out with, "So I hear that you're repeating my faults," and I think I kept them for 2.5 hours. You know, whatever it was, we've got it down on the CD presentation that's going up to the store this week. I think we got it down to just an hour and 15 minutes or something like that. Yeah, they're precious people and patient. I mean, these are great people. And we love you.
We do, and thank you, thank you.
So on to heaven and hell. We've been covering two topics, which are actually one. They're two separate topics, and yet they are interwoven. Can't teach on one without teaching on the other. And one of them is called dualism, which was the subject and topic of our latest Canadian foray. And I've just heard all of Michael's. Now, you'd be surprised to hear that I don't listen to Michael when he's teaching up there. He's just far too arrogant for my liking, so I go to sleep.
And I don't listen to Barris. I can't get through the accent. It's just terrible.
So we don't hear each other until we come back home. And this has happened for a couple of visits now in a row. And the last visit we had up there 6-7 months ago, we taught on dualism in its very early stages in its development in our minds. And we were amazed at how similarly we dealt with the subject, quite differently and yet very similarly. It was very instructional. And this time is the same. I taught on it from a totally different angle than Mike taught on it from. I loved what you said in your session, I think one or two, was that if you had to invent your own word, you'd call it two-ism versus one-ism. We've just happened to land on the terms dualism and unity.
Mm-hmm.
The other topic we've been teaching on is antinomianism. Now, in theological circles, in Christian circles, antinomian means anti-law. Oh, you're antinomian. And you never say it as a compliment. It's always, oh, he's antinomian, you know. He doesn't believe that the Ten Commandments hold for today. He doesn't believe that the law has a valid place in our Christian lives today. It's always a put down. It's always a pejorative. So, and I just upped, I think the other day, in your hearing, I just upped my offer to $5,000, a reward, to anyone who can give me an example of the actual word antinomian or antinomianism in any of the Greek sources for the Bible. So there's some easy money for somebody who's a bit of a, a heresy hunter. But when it comes to dualism, Mike, we have talked about holy beliefs, that is orthodoxy versus heresy, holy wars or orthodox murder. Christians used to call it the Crusades, Islamists call it jihad, versus love in action, holy places, the Orthodox Church buildings versus a church of living stones, holy people, Orthodox tribalism versus God-prized individualism, holy words or Orthodox language versus blasphemy. We looked at holy works, Orthodox works, you know, be it suffering or good works versus sinful acts. And today we're looking at heaven and hell.
Mm-hmm.
Orthodox rewards, using two of the most basic human manipulative devices. One, the hope of gain, and two, the fear of loss.
Yes, it has, this has to grow on you, Barris. The reality of the deception of these two subjects, it may have existed with other pagan religions or something, but was seized upon by Christianity, but never, ever was in the scriptures. Oh, my goodness. So only this past year did I work my way through the issue of heaven, still learning a lot about that, but then going back and recovering the issues of hell again. I did one of my sessions there in Calgary on the subject of Gehenna, and brought a little different focus on that topic that we may be able to get into a little bit later. But the fact that we go back to the scriptures to try to find this place called hell, we know that in Jewish communities today, no one goes to synagogue and has ever been taught about hell from the first time they go to church or go to synagogue as a child until they are laid to rest. They never hear about hell. When you take into consideration Jesus making the statement that if you wanted to understand the truth, you gotta go back to the scriptures. If somebody would have told me that hell was an invention of religion and nothing scriptural about it whatsoever when I was teaching on it, I don't know what I would have done.
Now, what you're saying is hell does not appear anywhere in the Old Testament.
Exactly. It's not there.
Well, what I want to know is this. I want to know, if we have to keep the law, you know, say the Ten Commandments, we have to keep the law, but we tear it apart so we don't have to keep it all. We only have to keep parts of it. You know, we don't have to keep the sacrifice bit and all of that stuff. And yet we do have to observe something that's not even, there's not even one reference to in the Old Testament. Is that what you're saying?
It is that ridiculous, yes. Not a single reference to, and the translators of the New Testament had to take the created word hell and go back and reverse engineer, if you will, the Old Testament and insert that word, that English word, into the Old Testament, the word hell.
Yeah, you're saying that they reverse engineered the Old Testament?
Concerning this, they sure did, because the term hell was created. This, not just the term, but the place hell was created by Christianity, by Catholicism. And you know, the one thing is interesting that, see, we never even deal with the term purgatory, but we got to realize that with Catholics, they don't just have heaven or hell. They got purgatory. And they consider purgatory a merciful place of a possibility of escaping at some point in the future, either the day after you go to purgatory or a million years later.
You can't have a purgatory without a heaven and hell.
Exactly. How can you have middle ground when you have no ground?
Yeah.
So, you know, even the Catholics thought that heaven and hell was just a little bit too extreme, so they inserted purgatory in between just so that they could give people hope that, you know, hell is not the final answer. If your heart is kinder than your doctrine, guess which one's wrong.
Sounds to me like that's what they did.
I think their heart was kinder than their doctrine. So they came up with purgatory. But since purgatory, they Protestants knew was strictly Catholic, they didn't bring that doctrine into the Protestant deception. I don't know when Protestants thought that would be a good one to drop out of the trilogy of heaven, hell, and purgatory. It's just amazing to me that they didn't drop the other two issues as far as destinations for human beings. Now, heaven is definitely a real place. Heaven still exists. Now, where heaven is, according to the teachings of Jesus and the New Covenant, has changed as to where it actually is, and it's the abode of God. So where God abodes has changed. But the term of people dying and going to heaven is only mentioned in the book of Revelation at all. But the term hell, not there.
Well, have you got any feeling which way you want to head? Do you want to head towards heaven today or towards hell? What would you like to lead on, Columbus?
Let's take everybody to hell today.
Let's take them to hell, okay. All right. You know those, I forget what you call them, they're special terms where you take a word and the first letter spells a different word. Mnemonic? I think it's a mnemonic. If I had a mnemonic for today, it would be, and you can figure out the first letters yourself, doesn't bother me, selfish hypocrisy ignoring truth. I mean, this is the granddaddy of all of the manipulative engineering of the Brain Change Corporation. It's the cornerstone of the corporation. Massaging two most basic human instincts, fear and greed, fear of loss, hope for gain. And it has produced some of the greatest masters of manipulation. I was looking at Rod Parsley and Pat Robertson on the TV just the other day. And Laura, you know, Laura says to me, why do you even have those channels on the TV anymore? And I say, shut up, woman. I want to get angry today. Now, do you remember the Y2K problem, Michael?
Yes, I do.
Y2K was something which was touted around the end of the last century, around 1996 onwards. I worked for a company dealing with Y2K, and I can say with absolute authority that Y2K was an invented problem, and it was invented so that we could come along and say, oh, but we have the answer.
Yeah.
And for a small sum of money, let's see, how much can you afford, we will get rid of the problem for you.
Yeah.
Now,
what did they call it? Y2K ready? Y2K?
Y2K readiness.
Yes, there you go.
Yep. And man, a lot of money was made out of that. A lot of money was made out of inventing a problem and then coming along. The same people who invented it came along with a solution. Now, the whole concept of hell is pretty much the same thing. I am God and I loved you so much that in case you didn't believe in me, I created hell.
Yeah.
Or I am God, and if you simply pay me this standover merchant sum of adhering to this particular faith, of this particular church, unless you pay me off, now, down on Main Street, that would be called a protection racket.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, that's what the whole concept of hell is. I want to read you, Michael, a quote from St. Augustine. This comes out of one of his books called City of God, and St. Augustine is an alleged saint whom both the Catholics and the Protestants have equal and exceedingly high regard for. This is what he said. Hell seems to have been invented on no other account, but as it was the business of princes out of their wisdom and civil prudence to deceive the people in their religion. Princes, under the name of religion, persuaded the people to believe those things to be true, which they themselves knew to be idle fables, by this means, for their own ease in government, tying them the more closely to civil society. In other words, if you have something for people to be afraid of, they'll behave better. Mm-hmm. You can manipulate masses better.
What a statement from somebody that it doesn't live in our generation, but was in the middle of the of all of this deception going on at the time. We need to listen to these voices. You know, there's people long before us, Barris, and along with us, I have to say, especially on this issue of hell. This is such a flagrant violation of terms and descriptions of what things are in the Bible, not just the scriptures, that people who don't agree with the gospel revolution at all, people that still are trying to win God's favor for miracles and trying to keep tragedies from happening and trying to get the devil out of their life, even people with all of those things still going have figured out, and maybe some of them long before we ever did, that I know definitely before I ever did, the fact that this was never in the Bible. It's not there. I did a 3-session series probably 10 years ago called The Irrelevance of Hell. So I compared hell to the cross. Well, the cross just simply annihilates any possibility of there being a hell for people to go to.
Why?
Well, this is what I would pose to people. And I would ask them, okay, so what was the cross? And people would say it was a place for sin, where sin was punished, or where sin was dealt with. And so I said, well, what is hell? Well, hell is a place where sin is dealt with. So if the cross was the finished work of God, then what is the use of another place for sin to be dealt with?
Well, some people would say, yes, but sin was dealt with at the cross. Now the only thing left is unbelief, and the only thing you're sent to hell for is unbelief, not for all your sins. Because of the obvious problems created by teaching and maintaining the hell doctrine, Christianity has come to say, well, no, Jesus did die for all sin, but it's your unbelief that sends you to hell.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, then unbelief is a sin for which Jesus didn't die, surely.
That's what they say. When the fact of it is that unbelief is the sin that Jesus died for. It is the sin, because that was the only sin that was the problem. The transgressions of the law came after the law. The problem came before the law ever came along. So the real problem would have been unbelief, if we understand the book of Genesis correctly in that subject. And that would have, the sin, the transgression of Adam, as Paul and Paul only taught about, that would have been the sin of unbelief. And that is what Jesus died for. And that is the sin that he took away as any consequence in relationship to God whatsoever.
There are probably 4 words in the Bible that are directly, there's only up to about, actually about 9, but there's 4 words which are quite important in the Bible, Sheol, Gehenna, Hades, and Tartarus, and these are all translated as hell. Now, 2 of them are exactly the same word, but we're going to get to, I want to get to the etymology of the word hell in a while. What I want to do is just go over 23 different phrases which we associate with hell. And these all appear in the Bible. So you can take those 4 words plus these 23 phrases and say, now there's nearly 30 different things in the Bible which we translate or interpret, doesn't matter which it is, as hell. Now here are the 23 phrases we interpret as hell. Fire, or a furnace of fire, unquenchable fire, hellfire, Gehenna fire, everlasting fire, or eternal fire, depending on which way you want to translate it. Fire on the earth, coals of fire, tormented in flames, lake of fire, saved by fire, worms that die not, gnashing of teeth, outer darkness, tormented forever and ever, unpardonable sin, broad is the way, depart from me, I never knew you, the damnation of hell, eternal damnation, the resurrection of damnation. He that believes not shall be damned. Everlasting punishment, everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. These are 23 phrases in the Bible that we, in our hell mentality, in our hell paradigm, we associate automatically with hell. Mm-hmm. Now, we know that they're used sometimes interchangeably. We know that they aren't all talking about the same thing, but it remains to be said that we associate all of these with hell, and along with hell, with punishment.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So what have you found out about these terms, Ferris? Where do you put these?
Well,
what is the context of them?
Well, you can't actually see the way our minds work. Our filters kick in, and we cannot even see some. If we're wearing red glasses, we can't even see anything that's red. The filters cut out those things. So what we need to do is we first need to decide whether or not hell is real, what it is.
And then look at these things in context.
Yes. Yeah.
I got you.
Now, let me just point out the hypocrisy, the utter hypocrisy of religion. And it's a hoax. This is, as I said before, like the Y2K hoax. The Egyptian hell was an Egyptian hoax. The Greek hell was a Greek hoax. The Babylonian hell was a Babylonian hoax. The Roman Catholic hell is a Roman Catholic hoax. Mm-hmm. The Islamic hell is an
Easy for you to say.
I was working with a guy once, and he had a speech impediment, and he said,
kind of like me working with you.
He said, you could take that to the bank, and. People, you can hate me. That's okay. You're going to have to stand in line. The first thing out of my mouth before my brain even registered was, oh, that's easy for you to say.
And the bank may be closed by the time you get there.
Oh, dear. Now, let me read you Matthew 18, verses 8 to 9. Wherefore, and this is Jesus speaking, if your hand or your foot offend you, cut them off and cast them from you. It is better for you to enter into life crippled or maimed, rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into everlasting fire. And if your eye offends you, causes you to sin, that is, pluck it out and cast it from you. It's better that you enter into life with one eye rather than having two eyes to be cast into hellfire. Now, our Christian friends would say, well, that was quite literal. That's a literal everlasting fire in verse 8, and it's a literal hellfire in verse 9. If that's literal, why don't you take the first part of the verse? Cut off your hand if it offends you. How many of you out there have masturbated?
Did you have to go there?
I would say it's the easiest place to go. I mean, everything else, people have some excuse to rationalize it, right? Well, maybe not, but you people who want to take that everlasting fire business literally, are you going to tell me your hand or your foot has never offended you?
Mm-hmm.
Ever? Or your eye has never? Guys, remember that girl that was walking down the street the other day? You were with your wife. You had your hand, your arm through your wife's arm, and you made sure she didn't see you looking, but you got a good eye for. Remember that?
Mm.
How come you got both your eyes?
Yeah, exactly.
So here we have a classic example of hypocrisy. We want to take part of a verse literally, and this is not another conversation. It's not another book in the Bible. It's not another theology. This is the same
verse. Yeah.
So there's a lot of hypocrisy in this.
Yeah, no doubt. So what was Jesus speaking about when he mentioned hell and hellfire? What are those words?
Oh, now you're going to make me look up my Bible. let's have a look at what those words were. Matthew 18, 8 and 9. I'm just reading off my running notes here, mate. Matthew 18, and you just go and I just turn the whole thing on its head here. Wherefore, if your hand or your foot offend you, and the word is scandalizo. Now, scandalizo is a word, it doesn't mean offend in English language. You know the mouse trap, mate? And the mouse trap has that little bit of thing with you put the bacon on or the cheese on?
Mm-hmm.
That trigger mechanism is a scandalizo.
Mm.
It's the actual mechanism that trips you up. So it means to be tripped up or to fall over in a stumble. So if your hand or your foot trips you up, you're listening, men, cut them off.
Yeah.
And cast them from you. It is better for you to enter into life crippled or maimed rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into aeonian, is everlasting, and pur, or fire. So age-enduring fire, whatever that age happens to be, it's an age-enduring fire. And if your eye offends you, better you than to be cast into Gehenna fire.
Very interesting. This is what I taught on, actually, in Calgary, this term Gehenna. And all of these other terms that have to do with fire, our God is a consuming fire, that would seem to correlate with what Jesus was talking about here. The fire that burns and is not quenched. Now, over the years, I've heard and accepted, and it's been convenient. It's never really set with me too completely well to call this Gehenna a garbage dump outside of Jerusalem. And the more that I looked at the consistency of this issue of fire was that the sacrifice for sin had to be consumed by fire. It had to be burned with fire. I remember many years ago, I've rehearsed this. It was one of the times where my brain was shocked into having to go look. Maybe 35 years ago, a gentleman walked up to me after a teaching session somewhere in the Midwest is all I remember. And he said to me, because I was teaching about the cross and the fact that everything was a type and shadow of the cross from the Old Testament pertaining to the sacrifices and all of that. And so he came up to me and he said, Mike, he says, do you believe this, that all of this is a type and shadow and that Jesus had to go through the very same process that all of this took place as far as sacrifices were concerned? For sin. And I said, well, yes, I do. And he said, well, good. He says, then you have to believe that Jesus was not buried. You have to believe that he was burned. And then, of course, what that did, it's like, you know, it's like, oh, dear Lord, what an idiot I've got on my hands. Let me tell you something. Sometimes you need to listen to idiots because they can spark a process by which you may learn something, even though the direct comment may not be true. Sometimes they've got something, you know. And so I went back and I started studying this issue of being burned with fire. And that's when I, long before I had any questions about hell, I read about this place outside the gate. That Jesus was crucified outside the gate, and that all of the sacrifices had to be burned outside the gate. So this fire that he said that had to consume the sacrifice, then this fire had to consume the body of Christ. And I really believe that what Jesus was making reference to in this place outside the gate was the place of his crucifixion. where that he himself spiritually, this fire, would consume everything. And thank goodness it was the body of Christ, hands and feet included, that was consumed by this everlasting fire, this fire that consumed the sacrifice outside the gate. And for those of you that want to know a little bit more about that, or at least hear me teach on it, the series from Canada will include that. But I'm persuaded in my own heart, Barris, that this this fire is the fire that was supposed to consume the sacrifice. And this everlasting fire, Jesus knew, he knew the scriptures, and he knew that the sacrifice had to be burned. And so this fire, like what Paul said, our God is a consuming fire. And the references to this fire are pretty thorough throughout the scriptures.
This outside business is a little thread that goes all the way through the Bible, outside the camp, outside the city, outside the gate, and it depends on who you follow as to whose opinion you'll have on that. Let's have a look at these different words that were all translated. Now, if I have a Spanish word for tree and another Spanish word for dog, and I translated both of those words into English as car, you would start to question my you'd start to say one or two things. Either you are lying or you're ignorant. And we know that the early translators of the Bible were not ignorant, not by a long chalk.
Yeah.
Here are the four words for which hell was inserted as a translation in English. The Hebrew word Sheol, S-H-E-O-L, was 31 times it appears there. In the Old Testament, the Greek word Gehenna, which appears 12 times in the New Testament, the Greek word Hades, which appears 10 times in the New Testament, and the Greek word Tartarus or Tartarus, that appears once. Two of these words mean exactly the same thing. That means we're down to three words now. The Hebrew word Sheol and the Greek word Hades are identical words, and they both mean one thing, a grave. They mean when you dig a hole and you put someone in it, and you cover it over with a bit of dirt and plant a few flowers, that is what these two words mean. Now we're left with the word Gehenna and the word Tartarus. These words are utterly different words than grave. They bear no relevance whatsoever to grave. Every time the word hell is found in the King Jimmy, it's translated from one of those four words. We find the word hell 31 times in the King James Old Testament, and 23 times in the King James Version New Testament, for a total of 54 times. Now, the English word hell, it actually comes, and this is from Webster's 20th century dictionary. It simply means to cover or conceal. To cover or conceal. Not to punish. And that's the Webster's 20th century dictionary. Let's have a look at the hell of the 21st century. From the American Heritage Collegiate Dictionary. The abode of condemned souls and devils, the place of eternal punishment for the wicked after death, presided over by Satan, a state of separation from God, a place of evil, misery, discord or destruction, a torment and anguish. I want to know how a word that means grave, quite clearly means grave, can be suddenly in the 20th century meaning this. See, if you told somebody in the Middle Ages to go to hell, you'd be telling them to crawl into a cellar and stay cool and concealed. But if you tell someone today to go to hell, mate, you're meaning quite a different thing. Now, here's my question. What in the intervening centuries has changed so dramatically that we insist today that the words in Greek and Hebrew do not mean what they said in Greek and Hebrew?
Yeah, it really is almost paralyzing to the mind. It is a shock, such a shock. Our cultures around the planet are not just influenced, but in many cases controlled by this deception. And like what you're saying, Barris, it's very difficult to think that this was not done deliberately. See if you can find it. And please don't go back to the default, well, Jesus said you'd burn in hell fire. Well, you've got to look and see if that word hell means what we have defined it to mean. And as opposed to what the Greek word actually meant. It's hard to pull your brain back from that and go back and quote the verse. Mike Williams and Barris Bartlett says there never was any place called hell, but look here, Jesus said you're going to burn in hellfire. Kind of proves them wrong, doesn't it? But it's along with many other things, it's just simply looking to see what these words, were they translated correctly? And this is a fact. They were not translated correctly. They were translated, it seems, deliberately incorrectly, and to take four different words and give them the one term of the non-existent word. How do you get beyond deliberate intent to do that?
Well, one of the things that modern forensic science insists on is looking for a motive. There are several things in modern criminal forensic science that we look for, and motive is one of them. So I look, Michael, for who was going to profit the most from creating this mistranslation. And it is a mistranslation, there's no question about it. In the Latin Vulgate, the term is ignium aeternum. You're going to habitate in ignem aeternum. Ignem, you recognize that in the word ignite. And aeternum, you recognize that in the English word eternity. Right there in the Latin Vulgate, we have the word aeonian, meaning for a predetermined length of time. Predetermined length of time, unless the context otherwise stipulates, in which case Paul says age without end. If it was an eternity without end, why would he have to say without end? So we know that the deliberate mistranslation of the word hell or everlasting fire, and I'm looking at that verse we looked at, we referenced earlier in Matthew 18, verse 8. You can look it up for yourself online in the English Latin Vulgate online, and then go to an English Latin translation. Just Google it. I mean, just do what I've just done. And there is no question that the Vulgate translation by Jerome deliberately, now either Jerome was ignorant, he just didn't know Greek, and he didn't know Hebrew, or he deliberately mistranslated. There's no other options.
Exactly.
Now, who was motivated the most to gain from this manipulation of words? Well, Jerome, the translator of the Vulgate, and we see this also borne out, if you want further proof, just go to the Douay Rheims version, which was the version of the Bible, the first version of the Bible ever printed in English by the Catholic Church. And the only reason they did it was because the common folks now had it already in Tyndale and in Wycliffe, in the Great Bible, the Bishop's Bible, and finally in the King James. They had it in their own language, that the Catholic Church felt that they had to release their own translation in English. Very convenient. But when you read it, they maintain this mistranslation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, so did all the Protestant Bibles. They maintained it as well. Why? I'm going to suggest that they had so profited of what the Catholics had profited of for centuries that it was too delicious not to include. And how did they profit? They profited in the pocket.
Mm-hmm.
You only have to read a modicum of history to understand that the church has been the biggest single receptacle of the common people's money, much bigger than taxes, over the last 20 centuries. So I think, Michael, the motives are clear. If you pay us money, we will keep you out of hell and put you into purgatory. Now, we know the Catholic Church was teaching that.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's no less rampant in the Protestant Church. If you give us money, you will get that.
Mm-mm.
That ranges from you'll feel good, all the way through to you plant a seed and you're going to get a harvest.
Yeah.
And, of course, once you've taught your truth for long enough, your pride won't let you back down.
Yeah. So there's been a modification of the not the translation, but the implications of the translation. Of course, the original intent of it, from what I'm hearing you say, Barris, it was, and that history is there. You're going to hell, and only money will get you out.
Remember Augustine that said earlier that the invention of hell was to keep people in their place.
Yeah,
he was a contemporary of Jerome, the person who mistranslated the Bible from Greek into Latin.
Yeah. So back to Jerome. I mean, goodness gracious! It seems that the clear intent was to find a way to. You know, people have been trying to find ways to extract money out of the masses ever since the masses have existed. And what an incredible thing to create a hell and say, we can keep you out of there. And not only that, but that if you give us enough money, we can keep you out of hell. But for your relatives who you know didn't give enough money,
yeah, now they're dead.
They're already dead, but if you give us enough money, we can get them out of hell, too. There is one line where he made that comment. I think Paul was referring to a doctrine that was being taught that he was challenging, which he said in that else.
Hey, but this is such a convenient doctrine, the doctrine of hell. And it manipulated me for most of my life. If you belong to those that group that believes you can lose your salvation, then hell is always an option.
Yeah.
It's never off the table.
Ooh, Lordy. Boy, that is for sure. And the torment that I've seen. I remember just coming to Barris, I've watched. We've taken brick by brick out of the wall until we figured out there was no damn wall there. I remember launching out into the greatest uncharted territories of Christendom and standing up in a meeting in Iowa and stating, sweating bullets and concerned for the outcome of my statements, that people who commit suicide can go to heaven. If they were saved, of course, that was even back then, you know, when you still had to believe. But if a believer committed suicide, they would go to heaven. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Now, what a firestorm that set off. This is why I'm interested in capturing the history of the gospel revolution, because, you know, people see almost this quantum leap, and it's never been a quantum leap, Barris. This has been slowly and methodically thought out, taught out, responded to, questioned, argued, debated, resisted, hated. There is a long history of this here. But here's what I want to point out to you about this, just trying to conceive some of the mental and emotional destructiveness that this issue of hell has caused. Now, we're only talking about a very small population of the people who commit suicide. Out of that meeting, now in that meeting, I had probably 75 people or so, best I remember. Out of that meeting, three people approached me after the meeting. One, their brother had committed suicide, and the horrible torture that it relieved them from of thinking that their brother was in hell. Two others came up and told me, that they had been plagued with thoughts of suicide most of their adult life and even into their adolescence. And they said, this, I don't think I can tell you, is what they told me. That when I told them that suicide was not a do not pass go, do not collect $200 straight to hell, both of them told me at that moment the obsessive thoughts with suicide left them completely. So now that's just with the term suicide and hell. We cannot, for you or collectively with you, grasp the enormity of the torture just mentally and emotionally, not counting what people have inflicted on themselves and others based on this doctrine. But we cannot calculate the mental and emotional torment that this has put people through. This was a group of 75. This was a group of 75 people. Three of them, there had to be more that were there that were impacted the same. Not everybody comes up and tells you what has happened to them during a particular teaching session, good or bad. But three came up in that session, and my gosh, it was the dawning of my understanding that something was so horribly wrong here that we would have to walk our way backward out of this by the same rope that brought us into it. And folks, I tell you, I really encourage you, when you're trying to get out of something, walk back out the same way you came in. Don't try to find a different door out, because you're going to leave yourself with all kinds of questions if you don't walk yourself backward out of that, line by line, bit by bit, piece by piece, until you get outside of this hurricane of nonsense that is killing you. And that's what we try to do here in the Gospel Revolution, is we're really trying to help you walk this back and say, where did I pick this up? How did I learn this? And why do I believe it?
Michael, there's one thing I don't understand. There's a couple of best-selling books on Amazon, like 23 Minutes in Hell. I died and I went to hell and God took me to hell and showed me all of these people being hung upside down by their God knows what's. And what do you say to that?
Hogwash. You know, there's a whole lot of people that have psychotic delusions. Why in the world do we turn to these people and declare that their personal experience supersedes Scripture?
If it's hogwash, how come they have these experiences?
The same reason that many people who are psychotic have these experiences. You can have psychotic experiences without being a psychotic, and they can be brought on by information, right or wrong, being fed into the brain. And then when you have a situation where oxygen is being depleted from the brain, when you are in a dire crisis, a health situation, and you are dying, these things begin to be reproduced right there in your brain. But you can't die and go someplace that doesn't exist. So I know that people want me to validate everybody's story. I can't do that. What about the Muslims that saw Muhammad when they had near-death experiences? And Muhammad was standing there with a bright light shining around him. So are we supposed to believe that also? I don't deny anybody's experience, but I refuse to let somebody's experience determine for me what truth is. And let me tell you this also. I refuse to let my own experiences determine to me what truth is. I can't help that my experiences will be colored by my experiences. But folks, as you go, you've got to, as you're searching for truth, drop even your own personal experiences. Because let me tell you, in Pentecostalism, Barris and I could tell you experiences that would validate everything we believed. But that is not where we're going to try to find the issue of truth. I'll never deny that the things that happened, at least in my perception, is the way they happened. I've talked about them with many people, and Barris and I have talked about them. But this is not where we derive truth from.
Michael, there was a book which, while it wasn't influential in changing my mind about hell, was possibly the best book I've ever read about the topic. Now, it was written by a girl who is not, as far as I know, she's not associated with us. Her name is Julie Ferwerda, J-U-L-I-E-F-E-R-W-E-R-D-A. The book is called Raising Hell, Christianity's Most Controversial Doctrine Put Under Fire. And the screed on it here reads on Amazon, "Have you ever considered the apparent injustices, inconsistencies, and even contradictions of the doctrine of hell? For starters, do earthly parents love their children more than God? Does God ask you to forgive your enemies when he is not willing to do the same? Is being punished forever for sins committed in a short lifetime really justice? Does everybody really get the same fair chance to believe?"
Yeah. Very legitimate questions.
These, and then she asks some questions. She says, if hell is the worst possible fate of mankind, and if God is truly loving, then why did he fail to mention hell in Genesis as the price for sin? Mm-hmm. Why doesn't the Old Testament ever teach about or even mention hell? Why doesn't Paul, the apostle to the non-Jewish world, ever mention hell once?
Mm-hmm.
Why has Orthodox Judaism, to whom scriptures were given, never believed in any kind of eternal punishment or hell? Why was hell not the Orthodox position of the early church for 5 centuries after Christ?
Mm-hmm.
Family, this book is going to cost you a whole, this is the ransom price for a small third world country, $2.99. Go and get it. The Kindle price, $2.99. If you want a hardcover or a paperback, do it. I didn't buy the thing in both formats, $11.99. It's $12. And we're not, we can share what we know, but by far and away the best thing we can do is point you in the direction of where you can read things and research things and listen to things and watch things that you can make your own mind up on. And this is one of them. I think I'll just put this in our book section this week, mate, because this is, mm-hmm, frankly one of the best books I've ever read on the topic, by a young lady, just a family lady with a husband and I think a family, and she's just read one of the best. She had a daughter that asked her about hell one day, and that's what started this whole thing going for her. So it's got 4.5 stars. It's a good book. Go buy it now. $12 paperback, $2.99 Kindle. With a Kindle, listen, you can get, I don't care if you've got an iPhone or an Android phone, you can download the Kindle app for free, and then you download the book onto that Kindle app. You can read it while you're on the bus or on the train or waiting in the doctor's surgery. Do what I do. Read it on your Kindle. We've given this. Is there anything we haven't done, mate? I just felt like a bit anticlimactic. I just almost felt like there should have been more to it than that.
No, I think that actually reading her questions about this, I think ending with questions is a good place to be. I mean, we've said a lot, we've pointed out a lot, but her list of questions, I think, are a good place to wrap this up.
Right. So, family, remember this about orthodoxy. If orthodoxy was to be trusted in the least, then wouldn't there only be one version of it? And so it is that we must leave you, family and friends. Don't forget to visit www.thetruegospel.net and order your copy of go and buy that book by Julie Furwerder, Raising Hell. Go to Amazon and buy that rascal. $12 paperback, $2.99. And, I mean, this girl asks, doesn't just ask questions, she answers the questions that everybody else asks, and you can't beat that. $1 a week, not much at all, but here at the Gospel Revolution, it can make all the difference for somebody else, just like yourself, starting their own journey towards thinking for themselves. We run a value-for-value model here. If you feel that you've received real value from this podcast, then I'm asking you to seriously consider donating anything. Donate $1 a week, $1 a day, $1 a month. Why don't you call our office on 321-220-4373 and speak to Jeffrey Robertson about how you can participate, or go to www.gospelrevolution.com and hit the donate link. By the way, we had a sneak preview of the new website, Mike. It looks absolutely bonza.
Yeah, does indeed. Yeah, we're excited about that.
Perhaps you'd like to invite Mike to your area. It's a messy business, but it could be easier than you might think. Call our office on the number we just mentioned with details, when, where, and why, and we're going to make that happen for you. You want to leave a message for Mike or a question for him to answer? Dial area code 234-564-0971 and leave a voicemail. No one seems to use it anymore, mate. I don't know if I just didn't get to check all the voicemails, but I wish people would use that. You can find us on Facebook at Friends of... You can find us on Facebook at Friends of Mike Williams and the Gospel Revolution. Thanks to Marcel Roos in the Netherlands, all the gospel all the time is being broadcast 24-7 at myradiostream.com/gospelrevolution. And now it's good night from myself, Beres Bartlett, from the GR Studios right here in Music City, USA. And...
it is good night right here from Michael Williams in Houston, Texas. Thank you guys so very much for listening in. And I hope we have successfully dismantled hell, or at least put you in question of it. It is such a powerful subject to get unraveled out of the brain. Many things about the gospel are simply unteaching the man. And if there's anything we want to unteach, we want to unteach hell.
Yes, I agree, Michael. Just because it says it in the English versions, it's meaningless, totally meaningless. If it doesn't say it in the original versions, then all you're doing is, well, you're learning like a parrot learns. Mm-hmm. We hope you enjoyed today's PowerCast, but if you didn't remember, just because you're offended, don't mean you're right. So if you prefer learning how to think to being told what to think, then join us again next week, same time, same channel, where we're going to do the same thing all over again.
Dada.